Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, from Stonewall to Pulse. On June 21st, Bloomington Pride hosted a panel discussion to discuss the recent Pulse massacre. They did this by going through history, starting with Stonewall and moving through time to discuss how LGBTQ individuals have been treated in the past. Doug Bader, Michael D'Annunzio, Glorianne Glow Leck, Duncan Mitchell, and Jean Smith were the panelists at the event. The group discussed the hardships they've faced over time, as well as how they think the treatment of LGBTQ individuals has changed. The panel took place at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Bloomington. Bloomington Pride hosted the event. Debbie Fish introduced the event, and Michael D'Annunzio moderated the panel.
So we started planning this panel about 2 months ago. And then with the Pulse massacre, we quickly realized there's so much more work to be done, and it sort of changed our thinking about it. From the constant media coverage from our own vigil last Tuesday, it became more and more clear that everyone sees life through their own lens, and that the best way for getting to a greater understanding, to walk in someone else's shoes just a little bit, is through meaningful, transparent conversations and deep listening. Deep listening is a little different. It's listening to understand, not just to prepare your own argument, your own defense. So we want to come with a very open mind. And we realize that this isn't easy to talk about. It may not be easy to hear. These people, they have a lot of history to share and a lot of information. So I'm going to introduce our moderator, Michael D'Annunzio. He's lived in Bloomington for nearly 35 years. He works at IU as the associate director of the Liberal Arts and Management Program, and he currently serves as the president of the Board of Directors for Middleway House in Bloomington.
I'm Michael D'Annunzio. Thank you to the UU Church for opening their space, as they so often do, to important conversations. I'm going to introduce our panelists, starting not with Doug. We'll come back to Doug. So we'll start with Jean. This is Jean Smith, born in Michigan in 1952. By 1958, she knew she was transgender. I lived mostly in Peru and was a clown in the circus and was the last group of children trained by the old professional clowns and my first exposure to gay people. She was a car mechanic and a drag racer. She came to IU in 1972 in general studies and opened a bike shop while still in school in 1975. That's Bikesmiths. That's still in operation. And this isn't in the biography, but Jean was, over the past weekend, elected as a delegate to the National Convention for Bernie Sanders. Next to Jean is Duncan Mitchell. Duncan Mitchell came to Bloomington in 1971 to attend IU, but also to come out. He immediately got involved in gay organizations here and has played some role in many of them ever since. From the late 1980s until 2014, which, if you can count, is a really long time, he was coordinator of the Bloomington Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Speakers Bureau. He has written for the gay press locally and nationally, and currently blogs at This Is So Gay. To my immediate left, Glorianne Leck, likes to be called Glow, was born in July of 1941, just prior to the Second World War. She grew up in a small town of 10,000 in north central Wisconsin. Her parents owned a family bar. Boy, there's got to be stories there, right? And that has been a major source of her education. She went to a one-room school and later to the University of Wisconsin at Madison and received advanced degrees in philosophy and educational policy analysis. She's taught at universities in Youngstown, Ohio, Penn State at State College, Penna, and New York University on the Manhattan campus and the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. She retired in 2005 and moved to Bloomington in 2006, married Susan Savastik, in 2013 after there having been domestic partners and lovers since May of 1993. Our latest addition, who is now at my far left, is Doug Bowder. Doug Bowder is the director of IU's GLBT Student Support Services Office and he's held that role since 1994. It's currently a unit of the Office of the Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. Doug is a former member of the Bloomington Human Rights Commission, and he's been associated over the years with the Campus MLK Planning Committee, the Commission on Multicultural Understanding, Bloomington United, and he's an active member of St. Thomas Lutheran Church and a founding member of the Coryland Men's Chorus. Been married to Marty Siegel for a while now. He's been with Marty for a long time. Not married for a long time, but I've been with him. And he's the father of 4 grown children and 9 grandchildren, active grandchildren. Okay. We've got some questions prepared, and I encourage you to craft your own as the discussion proceeds. Debbie will take them. I was asked to provide a little bit of background about Stonewall. Obviously, the situation at Pulse is painfully at the front of our minds. But to remind us all and sort of set a tiny bit of context, on June 28th in 1969 was a time when you could be arrested for dancing with someone of the same sex. Women had to wear at least 3 articles of female clothing, and that if that was absent, you were also arrested. If you were in drag, you were arrested. If you were dancing with someone of the same sex or congregating with other known homosexuals, you were arrested. That had been the case for decades prior to 1969. June 28, 1969 was also the day of Judy Garland's funeral in Manhattan. So things were already a little weird, right? The cops arrived at the Stonewall, a relatively small bar in Greenwich Village, if you've ever been there, around 2:30, and began their usual practice of rousting the people, tossing them into the paddy wagon and arresting them for being together. This time, though, people started fighting back. They threw bricks. They resisted arrest, and for the next several days, riots ensued in the village and around New York. It's commonly thought of as the birth of the Pride movement. In other words, you know, obviously, that June now is considered Pride Month, and that so many different communities all over the world now hold their Pride celebrations in June to commemorate that day and that event, that series of events. But it was also an interesting time, and that's one of the things I suspect we'll hear more about that. But that's a little bit of the background. And we've got, if it's okay, we'll proceed with some of our questions. And we can start with GLOW. Let's start from my immediate left. If you remember where you were when you first learned about the Stonewall riots, and what did they mean to you?
I heard about Stonewall riots probably a long time afterwards, because I was so busy talking about Vietnam and protesting required draft registrations. My life was full of the Black civil rights. I was being trained in nonviolent action by the Martin Luther King Jr. Group. And so Stonewall was just a little blip on the map. Now, I was a lesbian, and I was identifying with these other movements in terms of my people, which are all people who are oppressed. So I started from oppression and moved then to the refinement of the LGBT movement. So if I could leave anything with you, it would be to remember that we are a large community of oppressed groups. And when we try to do our history, we tend to pick out one thing. Stonewall really wasn't that significant. When you think about what was going on in bars all across the Midwest, where in my family bar, where one gay man in the community would come in and everybody would move to the end of the bar, and my mother and I and other people would go and try to make him comfortable. So bars were segregated, and that's part of what you saw before that. But in the municipalities, the big cities, they actually had rules. We kind of made them up as we went along in the Midwest.
Duncan.
Well, I grew up in rural northern Indiana. I graduated from high school, and I guess it must have been early June 1969. But I was already, I was a bookworm. As Alison Bechtel said, from a very early age, I knew I was different from other girls. At first, I thought it was just because I was smarter. Later, I realized I was right the first time. Alison did not say that. But I was reading about, and I was far from any activism, but I was following the civil rights movement. I was following the anti-war movement. I was informing myself and learning all that I could. I knew that I was gay, but I wasn't aware of what was going on then. And I think we should probably add that I disagree about the significance of Stonewall, though maybe not more as a matter of perspective than anything else. There was already a gay movement. For one thing, there was a gay movement in Europe, which we Americans often forget about. It had been founded in around 1900 in Germany, and it spread around Europe. It was dealt a serious blow by the Nazis, and then resurged after World War II ended. The Netherlands was probably the most important site of it at that time, right through the 1950s. There had been sporadic gay organization in the United States, sometimes influenced by the German movement. And in 1948, the Mattachine Society was founded in California. So there was a history, and it had been spreading and growing. And people, younger people, each new generation of gay kids was getting more and more impatient. The militants of other movements in the 60s affected people. So I think of Stonewall as sort of like something coming to a boil. People had been getting more and more impatient. Mattachine and the other gay organizations, Daughters of Bilitis, One Incorporated, were also getting more militant, but older members, older, wiser members, no doubt, but still perhaps too cautious, were holding things back. There had already been a national convention of what were then called homophile organizations in the 60s. So Stonewall, as I say, was building on something that had been building for a while. Now I'm pretty sure I was reading the Village Voice, the New York City weekly alternative newspaper, and I had started reading underground newspapers from the West Coast when I could hold them. For that, I had to go to South Bend, but by then I could drive. So, anyone from South Bend remember the newsstand on?
Still there.
It's still there, run by a couple of old beatniks, and they carried all kinds of neat stuff that was not in the library back home. So I was reading The Voice, and I'm pretty sure, I may be just projecting, but it seems to me that I remember reading about the Stonewall riots probably the week after they happened, when they were covered in The Voice. They were also covered in the New York Times, but I was not reading the Times. So, but that was just chance, it was just luck. And it didn't make a big impression on me at the time. But within 2 years, it was kind of like the kickoff for, I think of it as the birth of the gay liberation movement. The gay movement started in the, much earlier, but the gay liberation movement was kicked off by that, an increased visibility and militance and anger. And before long, most campuses around the university, most cities of any size, had gay organizations and people coming out and using their own names. The Mattachine leaders had been kind of notorious for using pseudonyms, which was, reasonable. You could lose your job. You could be, hounded and killed. The newspapers, if you were caught up in a bar raid, the newspapers would print your name, address, and often employer if they could get it from the police. So a lot of people's lives were ruined by that at the time. The new militants involved, which had also had been coming along, I think that some of the younger, angrier members of Mattachine and other groups have been using their own names anyway already. But certainly it stopped, there was kind of a sea change. And suddenly there was a visible gay movement everywhere. People insisting that the newspapers talk to them and not just to the police. Insisting that we were the experts on our own lives. Confronting the psychiatric profession, the medical profession. That had been building, as I say, but it just suddenly everyone said, oh, why the hell not? Let's get out and stir up some stuff and let's do some things, and they did. So, but that didn't really affect me for another year. When I began reading in the Chicago underground newspaper, The Seed, about the gay organization up there, I attended one of their meetings, met other people who I knew to be gay for the first time. There were people I knew who were gay, but I didn't know it at the time. And became a card-carrying homosexual. I joined the group so I could be a card-carrying homosexual. And that was very satisfying. I think I still have the card somewhere. And went back and came out to some of my friends at IU South Bend, where I was going at the time. So yeah, it had an impact on me, but it was slow. Still, it looks like it was. I was aware, you know, I was really more aware of the anti-war movement and SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, the New Left. And I was more concerned about being drafted than I was about coming out. But that was my experience, and that's all I can really tell you about.
So I was transgender, as I said. In 1958, I realized that we didn't have the word transgender, but basically I was a cross-dresser. And I was ashamed of it immediately. I was never caught. And I was in the closet, and to me, my method of being in the closet was to never even research it, because I never wanted to be caught looking at a book, going to the library. And so if something came across in front of me and it was, you know, and there was nobody around, I was able to learn about what that meant, and I did learn over time. By the time I was in high school, probably mid-high school, I knew of transvestite and transsexual, which were the words, and what the definitions of those two things were, and what it required to have a sex change operation, as it was called then. And I didn't feel as though I qualified to be a transsexual, so I thought of myself as a fetish cross-dresser and hated myself and thought I was the ugliest of people. So my perspective was from the point of view of someone, and the other thing was I have been, and I've experimented recently, you know, with men, but in general I was female attracted, and that really hasn't changed. So my whole life at that point was separating what I now believe in as soul, and I didn't believe in soul back then. I thought it was an absurd concept that had no real meaning. But I realized later that I had a soul because I couldn't change it, even though I tried. So I had this set of things that I could show you and everybody, and then I had this small set of things that were me that I had to hide from everybody. And I did that. So GLBT, as we call it today, or LGBT, wasn't really a part of my life. But I was definitely young, revolting against my parents' beliefs, and I was opposed to the war. Woodstock was going on at just about the same time. Free love, the sexual revolution. I witnessed the race riots on television in black and white. The shooting of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were things that we watched on television. So that's sort of my perspective, and I won't go on too much more about, as far as when I learned about Stonewall. I came out of the closet 8 years ago, I got involved with Pride Film Festival. And actually, I learned about it within the last 7 years through my association with the Pride Film Festival.
I was 19 when Stonewall happened. I was a sophomore in college, and like most of us here around the table, the concern was staying alive and staying out of Vietnam. My draft number was high, so I would have been drafted. It turns out that I went on to seminary, so I didn't have to worry about that for a while, but the war and civil rights were the issues. I do remember a story on the evening news about Stonewall. And it's interesting, as you're talking, as we think about how the TV informed our lives in those days before, obviously, the internet and everything, and how we saw the world through three major networks, basically, as we were growing up, or as I was growing up. I remember a story about Stonewall, but my image of the people who were protesting and who were being arrested is, because I wasn't out at that point, I didn't identify as gay. It was another 12 years before I could come to terms with that issue in my life. I was a pretty straight-laced, church-going kid in Pennsylvania. So the images of those, of the people who were the real leaders of Stonewall, as they were folks who today I think we would identify as transgender, they were people of color, a number of Puerto Rican individuals, and they were drag queens, they were folks who frequented leather bars, as I've done some research about that time period, and they were folks who I didn't identify with. They were urban individuals who I found kind of interesting, but I actually think because the way the media portrayed them, it delayed my own coming out, because I assumed, oh, that's what gay people are. And they were making a big deal about this on the news, about this event in New York, but I thought, well, I certainly had some inklings that I might be gay, but no, I must not be, because this doesn't really pertain to me. It's only in time that I've realized the significance of that event and the heroism of those people who stood up for our rights so long ago and in some amazing ways. So the history has become important over the years, but at that point in time, it really was just a blip on the radar screen, particularly in contrast to the anti-war demonstrations that were going on, the civil rights demonstrations, and I was at a small liberal arts college, but we were very involved in those events.
You've been listening to From Stonewall to Pulse on Standing Room Only. Listen to the panelists discuss their memory of Stonewall and their journey since then. This panel was hosted by Bloomington Pride on June 21st as part of Pride Month. We now return to the moderator Michael D'Annunzio asking his next question.
Let's start with Doug again. So, keeping the context of the history in the center of our mind here, where were you, and what are your thoughts about the Pulse massacre as it situates within the context of the history that we've all just described from the various perspectives? And also, I think it'd be interesting to think about the way that you mentioned back in 1969 we got our news from three different TV networks, which was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. It's part of the reason the Vietnam War was so controversial, because for the first time people saw this. Now, bodies in the street are tragically commonplace. We know about it within minutes of its happening. So I'd like to hear your feelings about that, and I think it'd be interesting to put it in the historical context that you've described.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is we can look back at Stonewall and think people were injured, as I recall. I don't know that anyone was killed. Yeah. Have we really made any progress? You know, when I heard us from Stonewall to Pulse, I thought, oh my gosh, what a fascinating bringing together of these two bars, again, people of color in a bar who were targeted. Now it's religious
issues that are surrounding this or sort of religious issues. But I guess the incredible amount of media. So the good news, I guess, is that folks have responded to this. It's not just a blip on the radar screen. This event was huge, Pulse. And folks have responded with outrage to it. You know, in 1969, it was hardly noticeable all that much. So there certainly are differences as I think about it, and it's in the media everywhere. And so have we made progress? Yes and no.
As far as where I was, I remember I was traveling. I can't remember exactly. I went to Denver recently. I don't remember, but I remember I read something real quickly on Facebook, and I was away from it most of the day, so I didn't really hear about it until late in the day after Pulse. And one of the things that bothered me is that a lot of my friends were crying all day long, and I felt guilty that I couldn't cry. Took a while. But at any rate, as far as progress, I mean, what I think about Pulse, I think we are making progress, and I think what happened was a sort of a reaction to the progress. I think that these bathroom bills are a reaction to the Supreme Court making marriage equality. I think it's the reactions of people who are losing power and becoming a minority. And my hope is that, and it's something else I think about. You know, we talk about privilege, and we got marriage equality, and I think we all have white privilege, and we think, oh, this is all going to change now. And I think back, and the Civil War was about 170 years ago, I think, ago. And the civil rights laws were 50-some years ago, you know. And it's so, like, when we're in a civil rights battle, and for us as white people to think, you know, this is going to happen overnight, I think it probably is going to happen overnight relative to what's happened for black people with civil rights. I think because we are going to assimilate faster than that, but for us to think that it's going to happen just because of one civil rights decision of the Supreme Court is a little naive too. But so the last thing I want to say about this is that I do look at it the way what happened in Atlanta. I mean, Georgia had the Confederate flag flying in all over that state until a year ago when another gunman went into a church and killed a bunch of people, and that's what it took to get them to take those flags down. And so the most positive thing that I can see out of Pulse is as we go into another legislative session next year and they bring these bathroom bills in and they try to stop our equality acts and that sort of thing, I think we have gained something a little bit politically, and that's a sad way to have to look at it, but if you want to look for a silver lining, I think that might be the one silver lining to what's happened.
I remember where I was when I heard about the Pulse massacre. I was on my way over to the Union Building, going into the Union Building on that Sunday morning. I don't have TV. I do not watch TV. I don't follow. I don't listen to the news. Basically, I don't hear much when Democracy Now! Isn't on. And so Monday through Friday. And a lot of stuff I get from print media and online media from a variety of sources, including international. So the Union often gives me a touch of news. And the TVs there were tuned to CNN, and they were talking about there'd been a killing. And I watched long enough to find out roughly what had happened, and then I went to the marketplace, the food court, and got out my laptop and connected to the internet and found out about who had been killed and where and so on. And I just felt a great sense of hurt in my gut, hurt in my heart, because it was one more. And I also knew that the what exactly had happened and what it meant was not going to be clear for a while. That's the trouble. We may have a lot more information thanks to all the media, but it takes as every bit as long as it ever did to find out what happened, why it happened, and what it means. So everybody's in a hurry to get the scoop. Everybody's in a hurry to find out what happened immediately. But you can't find out what happened immediately. And so I've been following it since and watching the reactions. Yeah, I think it's still too early. We still don't really know why the shooter did what he did. It doesn't help that he's dead, though I'm just glad that he is. But even if he were alive, we'd have a very difficult time finding out his motivation. And in a lot of ways, his motivation doesn't really matter. I can't see the Pulse massacre. I'm really glad to see you using the word, because it seems to me that a lot of what I see about it, people are avoiding the word massacre. And it was a massacre. I mean, what else can you call 50 people dead in 10 minutes, whatever? But anyway, going back, I think it is ultimately, this is just a guess because we won't know for a while, but my guess is that it will be a blip compared to Stonewall because of what Stonewall set off. The Pulse massacre occurred in the context of great gains that we have made over the past 50 years as gay people, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, and our allies and our families and our friends. It was also not about what gay people did, unless Omar Mateen was gay, as looks possible, but we don't know. It was, Stonewall was gay people acting. Pulse was us being acted on. And so I can't see it as important in the same way, or meaning the same kind of thing. I think the main similarity is that they both happened around bars, which is, you know, not enough to build something on. We've been struggling for these things. The movement's been growing, but it also encounters backlash. As the sociologist Philip Slater said back in the 70s, if you don't get a backlash, it's not real change. And everything we can do, there will always be resistance. Getting rid of the Confederate flag from public display is a good idea, but it's not going to stop people from flying it. I just saw a truck flying, a pickup truck flying the Confederate flag and the U.S. flag and maybe something else this morning, driving down the street in Bloomington. So it's not going to go away. You can't make these things go away. I think one of the biggest mistakes we often make, that many people make, is this feeling that we can make something happen overnight. Nothing happens overnight. When it does, then there's still work to be done afterwards. So as terrible as it was, I don't think that it's going to set us back. In some ways, we make some gains from it. I think we're going to see some losses as well. But over the long haul, what counts is what people do. And the killing is not going to really change that.
Well, again, I would like to put it in a different perspective. I checked on the internet today, and I don't know about reliability, but I was reading a statistic that said 500 LGBTQ and I individuals were killed in 18 months between 2014 and 2015. That's a lot of our people. And as anybody who's trans knows in particular, those are pretty violent, awful killings, and they're often just an individual or two people. It always is more dramatic in our society if there are more people because we do numbers. For years, I have watched in the lesbian community women being destroyed by disease, for instance, breast cancer, which a very large number of us have or have had. And those are just not studied because they're just women. So you've got that women, that feminist, those feminist issues. This was a nightclub. Most of the individuals who were killed were Latin, many from Puerto Rico, and they were primarily male. That's a step forward. The clubs are more integrated now. When I started out, we had lesbian-only groups and we had gay men-only groups. And the trans sexuals or the drag queens or the transvestites kind of had to find a niche somewhere, and Stonewall was one of those. Now, this club had another kind of identity thing with a Latin thing, partly because of location in Orlando and near the islands and so forth. So I consider that an attack on an ethnic group as well. And that's part, again, for me, of the civil rights thing of oppressed groups. We don't know whether this guy was out to kill gay people generally, or whether he might have been rejected by some Latin fellow who he tried to pick up. So we don't know, but we do know that these crimes are very often dominant over smaller groups. Now, in this case, the complication that he's a Muslim, and that's a minority group as well, really messes up how we perceive this. So I think it's a much larger event than Stonewall because of the media. I think that's been said. Stonewall, we had three channels, as you said. I was reading those underground newspapers too and saw it in The Voice. But now we just get this overload of, I mean, they're just killing this topic every day. It's been, and it's important. But think of the other people who've been scared to death by this. How many of our gay young people are going to go back in the closet because they're afraid to go to a club? But there were so many things that have gone on to keep our community alive, to make connections. And you overlay that with the civil rights movement and feminism. I mean, I came out as a feminist before I came out as a lesbian, and still cannot consider myself to primarily be fighting patriarchy, which puts me in a secondary position all the time. I have more trouble as a woman than I do as a gay woman. In fact, I have privilege as a gay woman. Believe that. I mean, just chew on that one. It just tells you the whole thing about hierarchy. So I think the pulse was horrible. And I so appreciate that Pride did that service the other night or whatever. Just a great job. Just a great job. Brought a lot of people together. And we're seeing that kind of eking out across the country. Huge gatherings in Orlando and other places. That's for us to say to the world, we're here, we're not going away, and you're going to deal with us. So it's kind of, that's the reaction that's more Stonewall. We're coming out and saying, you're not going to push us back just because you're got some Looney Tune or whatever out there expressing his horrors. And then we do have the gun issue now that's very big related to this.
Just one further thought. I don't think I need, well, all right.
Sure.
Nixon had just been elected in 68.
It's on.
Okay, Nixon had just been elected in 68, so we weren't dealing with presidential politics when Stonewall happened, but the way that this event has become a hot potato in a presidential election is remarkable and maybe sad in lots of different ways, but that dynamic is certainly different than 1969. I can't imagine these sorts of issues being, or the Stonewall issue being a part of a presidential campaign. I can't imagine that anyone was talking about that. So,
gay people have always been, in my lifetime anyway, part of lower level election campaigns because it was routine for bar raids and clearing out the parks to happen during campaign season so that a candidate could, the incumbents could say, yeah, we're cleaning up the place, we're getting rid of the queers. So it's always been a factor, just maybe not as overt, not on a national level. But again, these things are complicated to sort out. I'm not running down your analysis particularly, but this is just something else we have to add to bear in mind.
You've been listening to From Stonewall to Pulse on Standing Room Only. listen to the panelists discuss their thoughts on the Pulse Massacre and how the public reaction has changed since Stonewall. The panel was hosted by Bloomington Pride and is a part of Pride Month. We now return to Michael D'Annunzio asking his next question, dealing with the mainstream portrayal of LGBTQ individuals.
There were some allusions to this in a as Duncan pointed out, the incumbent's efforts to clean up the queers before the election, much like they do with homeless people now before the Olympics or some other big event. Whoops, that came out. And or a lot of different things. But the question really is, how is the question I'm trying to get to here is, how has mainstream or the dominant society's image of the queer community changed over the last several decades? I mean, considering the fact that they had the tools of the medical society to, or the law, two ways to incarcerate us. Juxtapose that with lots of people knowing a gay person now. We can start with you, if that's okay. And yet they still shoot us, which I guess is the other bookend.
I think the best way I can get inside the head of a very traditional conservative straight person or bisexual in denial or whatever, we have all those things out there, is that they say, okay, there's another minority group, and they want us to accept them. What the heck, as long as they're not bothering me. I really feel dismissed. The marriage thing was the bone. Okay, go ahead. You want to get married, fine. The issue always has been, in my mind, what men do, because in patriarchy, men do not want to lose their brothers, because that's their strength. They don't care about women. Susan and I shack up, or we do whatever, they don't give a damn. We don't count. They just, so we do our little jobs, whatever, and they do them well, and I've heard they hire a lot of lesbians because, you know, we work really hard to be accepted. So that's kind of where that comes from. So I think the society has basically thrown us a bone and said, okay, you can have your gay marriage. But damn it, don't push further. So no bathrooms, okay? I don't want to pee next to you. I mean, that's...
Well, and the marriage issue makes us look like them.
That's right. It makes us look like
them. It's an assimilationist agenda. So the more that... No.
I think you would have to ask the mainstream how they view us now and how their views have changed. And I don't know that they know. When someone gets... I've spent a lot of time reading and arguing. Thank goodness for the internet. It's been a great way to learn what other people think or are not thinking. When someone says, tries to be dismissive, you know, I don't care what they do as long as they don't frighten the horses. If you listen after they've made their PR pronouncements, you can often find that it's not, they're not that dismissive. Certainly one thing, a lesbian once pointed out to me that, in her experience, men were initially dismissive of lesbians until they found out that a lesbian really was not available to them. That they were, you know, she wasn't going to go out, she wasn't going to date him, she wasn't going to do what he wanted. And patriarchy didn't like that. So I wouldn't be too sure that lesbians are necessarily privileged. And it, the on the surface, maybe, but the resistance is, after all, what is, I was reading a book about lesbian softball teams recently, a wonderful book, made up largely of interviews with lesbians who've been in women who've been involved in women's softball. It was published in the 80s. And the fascinating thing was that one of the women, who was a lesbian, started dismissing women who were too unfeminine. Feminists, because the terms and the stereotypes she used were exactly those that are used to describe lesbians, for being unfeminine and butch and manly. It is complicated. Again, I think it is important. I think our visibility has been important, and a lot of that visibility has come not through organizations, though I value organizations, but through people being courageous and telling their families, telling their bosses, telling their friends. Baby steps, one little bit at a time, so that very few people anymore can honestly say, in this country anyway, that they don't know a gay person. But even in the 70s, when we were speaking to classes, when there would always be kids saying, oh, my uncle's gay, my dad was gay and before the divorce, and that's why the divorce, my brother, my sister, my aunt, my grandma, my coworkers, you had to wait a little bit, but people would tell you that they knew us. And that, I think, has made an important difference. You can't. It's harder to think of queers as somebody out there somewhere. They're at home in a way that other minorities usually are not. It's possible to see them as other. They're not. Unless your brother marries a Jewish lady or something. But it doesn't. It doesn't just grow next to you. And I think that's an important distinction. But I'm also ambivalent about the whole idea of assimilation. This is something that queers have been arguing about for decades now. I'm not really sure what it means. We're born assimilated. We're born into straight families for the most part. And we have to de-assimilate and find a community. And we have to assimilate to the gay communities that we find. And this has often been problematic, for me at any rate. I quickly found that other gay people were trying to tell me how to be gay. And I wasn't going to let them do that any more than I was going to let straight people do it. So assimilation that whole issue raises important questions, but I'm not always sure what they are.
Well, so I guess my perspective is a lot different. And from the WFHB audience, this is Gene Smith, and the people here see a woman, but you're all hearing a man because my voice sounds this way. So, like I said, I came out 8 years ago, and I remember reading, at that time, I mean, all transgender expenses, medical expenses, no chance of that being covered. The military was the first to do any coverage of hormones and that sort of thing. And I remember reading that surgeons who did, gender reassignment surgeries were always paid for by the people who were getting the surgeries. And they said that most of them, or a lot of them, were paid for in cash. And the reason was the people who were getting those, they couldn't get a job at McDonald's. So they were sex workers. They sold themselves to get the money to have the surgeries that they needed. I remember a few years ago, there was the trans woman pulled out of the bathroom by two or three women at a McDonald's and beaten into unconsciousness, And I thought, here's an opportunity. McDonald's should do a gender-neutral bathroom. They should just make that part of their floor plan and everyone and come out with a policy that they'll hire transgender people. And I thought, what wonderful workers we would be, because we would be so appreciative that we could have a job at all, So, and then one other thing is that it's reported recently, I don't know how recent the study was, but more people in America say they've seen a ghost than have seen a transgender person in their lifetime. And that's really important. I think the people that we see like me, the reason I ran for delegate is that I think we need to be seen at that convention because the bathroom bills. And the bathroom bills are the American Family Association, the attorney who represented, what was her name, the clerk down in Davis, Kim Davis down in Kentucky, that group, which basically I would call a church think tank, has tried to figure out how to slow us down, how to stop us from being connected to the civil rights laws of the United States. And what they've come up with is that we can divide the T off of GLB by doing this. It's happened before, so that they're, you know, they so, you know, it can cause division within the community. They found that it sells. In Houston, they had a civil rights ordinance, and the opponents got a judge to look at how it had been done, and the judge said that wasn't done in a legal fashion. You have to do a resolution. And the Human Rights Commission spent $3 or $4 million fighting to keep that civil rights ordinance, and the opponents made one commercial that showed a little girl walking into a bathroom with a voiceover throughout the commercial, and it talked about how if you vote for civil rights for these people, you are going to allow men to go into the bathroom. And the commercial ended with a little girl in the back of the stall looking over the shoulder of a man. And my friends down in Houston said, your family members turn against you and people, and I put it up on my Facebook page for about 10 minutes, and people who had supported me were saying, oh, they got a point there. And it's so emotionally powerful that it will turn people against people, and you can't argue it with logic. The only answers are emotional, you know, and we're starting to learn what those things are. But basically, we are the target, and it's your fight, you know. I mean, it's aimed at marriage equality. But so I'm going to move on quickly. But basically, in the 8 years since I came out, and which happened to be the 8 years that Obama was in office, from my perspective, trans were not very politically active, and everything came our way just sort of as a gift from the sky, you know. And it was because we weren't on the radar, you know. It was about marriage, that was the thing, and it's the same sort of arguments being used against trans now, but basically it's the people they've lost, and this is their last fight, hopefully their last fight. But so much has changed. I mean, trans people now can get jobs. I mean, I think you know, you've been visible the whole time, but if you look at it from the point of view of those of us who are invisible, I don't know. I mean, I just can't. I really think things have changed, and I think people are aware of us and gender identity. I mean, things that I never thought that, you know, that would happen are just happening. So I think the understanding is just amazing. And last thing, it seems to me like gays do want to assimilate. I mean, I heard there's four lesbian bars in New York City now, and it has more lesbian bars than any other city in the United States. Talbot Street in Indianapolis will be closing down permanently here real soon. I was in the Pride Parade a couple of years ago, and I don't know, this is on WFHB, so I don't really want to say how I was dressed or whatever, but I do want to say that basically a lot of people were told that if anybody ever did that again, nobody from that community would ever be in the parade again. And they said because they're kids. And I thought, so the Pride Parade is a kids' parade now, you know, and you can't do a protest. I mean, I was doing something completely legal for any woman. The law in Indiana says a woman must cover her nipples. On the other hand, nobody, men or women, can show any part of their butt. And that's the law, you know, and all I was saying is, we can go any place like this without violating the law. This is legal. And I was planning to take 100 women to do exactly what I did the next year. And we were told that, you know, if any woman showed up in pasties, there would never be, you know, another burlesque group ever allowed in the Pride Parade. So, I mean, I think we're trying to assimilate to the point that the Pride is no longer a place where you can protest. It's a family, a friendly event. So that's my thoughts.
I think we're still thinking about what mainstream people think. Is it, was that sort of the question? I'll just take a quick stab at this and say, you know, one of my privileges is that I get to talk to students regularly, many of whom do not identify as queer, and who see our issues as civil rights issues. That was certainly the case with marriage equality in Indiana a few years ago, when a huge number of IU students were involved in Indiana equality. Whatever you think about marriage equality, a lot of straight students were behind that. I have to think the other night with the 1,200 people at City Hall that they weren't all queer people. It was a wonderful representation from our community, but it was also a wonderful representation from our allies. And the last thing I'll say is, you mentioned the number of grandkids that Marty and I have together. Those kids are amazing in their defense of their gay gramps and their gay grandpa. And that's huge for me. And it makes me have hope, and I have to have hope if I'm going to continue this work.
I have to tell you now, don't. We have a six-year-old niece, grandniece, and she was at that event the other night, and she was the one who was edging her way up the stairs, the redhead, if any of you saw her. And we asked her the next day, you know, what were you doing? She said she wanted to go up to the podium and sing Kookaburra because it has gay in it. 6 years old.
Okay, I'm gonna stop us because we need to be finished on time, but please help me thank these wonderful panelists.
You just listened to five panelists discuss the Pulse Massacre and the history of treatment of LGBTQ individuals in America. The panelists discussed how they believe they are portrayed by the mainstream media, and they discussed what they think we can do to make life safer for LGBTQ individuals in America. The panelists today were Doug Bader, Glorianne Glow Leck, Duncan Mitchell, and Jean Smith. The moderator for the event was Michael D'Annunzio, and Debbie Fish both introduced and closed out the event. The panel was hosted by Bloomington Pride at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Bloomington, and it was held on June 21st.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.